Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest for the second hour, and we go back to the internet for all of our questions. It's an internet open forum, so if I give out the number, that will be a mistake on my part because we're not giving out the number today. We're just taking all of our questions. They've already been, I shouldn't say we're taking them from the internet. They have been taken already from the internet. So if you'd like to participate in internet open forum in the future, maybe you are connected to Jimmy in some way and the social media accounts and all that, you can do that, or you can just send it to us at radio@catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, senior by virtue of production and success and all of that, but also by virtue of time here. And this is the 30th anniversary of Jimmy's first day here at Catholic Answers. Jimmy, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not only the senior apologist, I'm the senior employee.
You are the senior employee. That is so wild. And this place has had some long-term employees, mm-hmm. too. It's not like people come here and just flit back out again. But you're the champ now. You are the champ, my friend. And we'll keep on fighting till the end.
Well, we are the champions.
thank you for giving us, including us all in that. Internet open forum, a whole bunch of questions for Jimmy. And this one comes from John. What's a good response to someone who insists that believers don't need a hierarchy?
Well, I'd say a few things. One is he doesn't understand human nature. Mm-hmm. Humans spontaneously form hierarchies. It is a human universal. Hierarchies appear in every culture, everywhere in the world, in all of human history. Virtually all organizations, large and small, have hierarchies, whether mm-hmm. it's a little club that's purely voluntary or a major nation. It's got it almost always has a hierarchy, either, and usually it's a formal hierarchy where you have someone, where you have like elected officers. But even if you don't have that, you have an informal hierarchy where certain people just step forward as leaders and get things done. And so all large organizations have to have hierarchies. You know, if you have hundreds or thousands of people, much less millions or billions, you need a hierarchy to organize a group that's so large. And if the group is going to endure through time, if it's going to be long lasting, it's also going to need a hierarchy that can provide effective leadership. Therefore, hierarchies are part of human nature. Now, Cy Kellett, is the church meant to be an organization?
It is indeed, yes. It's an organization.
Is it meant to be large by Jesus?
It's supposed to be universal. I believe it's in the title.
Okay. And is it meant to be enduring?
Yes. It is indeed meant to be enduring till the very end.
Right, because he said the gates of hell will not prevail against it, and he's going to be coming back at the end of time, and so it's not going to pass out of existence. So the church is meant to be a big, enduring organization. That means it needs a hierarchy, and we see that hierarchy reflected in the New Testament itself, where, for one example, the author of Hebrews tells his readers, who were first-century Christians, to obey those who are over them in the Lord. So we see a hierarchy with obedience in the first century church. And therefore, we know both by first principles of human nature and what the church is, and also by explicit testimony of the New Testament, that there's supposed to be a hierarchy in the church, and therefore believers need a hierarchy.
And thank you very much for that question, John. We do appreciate it. It's an internet open forum. I'm going to say Rio. I don't know how to pronounce the name, so I'm going to say Rio. When Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, actually wrote JTB, but I'm guessing that means John the Baptist. Did John hear God say?
Who else was Jesus baptized by?
I know, I guess. So I guess I could, by I used context clues on that one, Jimmy, to know.
Good.
When Jesus was baptized by JTB, did John hear God say that Jesus was his son? If so, why did John ask Jesus if he was the Messiah in Luke 7?
So according to the Gospels, John did realize that when he baptized Jesus, he did have a visionary experience in which Jesus was declared to be God's son, and that helped him identify Jesus as the coming one, as the Messiah. So at the time of the baptism, John knew that Jesus was the Messiah. But then, according to the Synoptic Gospels, he later came to have some doubts. And he sent some of his followers with a message to Jesus saying, "Are you the one we're looking for or not?" And the presumed reason for that is, well, Jesus wasn't acting like the kind of Messiah that John expected. Many Yep. people in the first century expected a political Messiah who would start a revolution and kick out the Romans and restore a political monarchy to Israel. That was widely perceived, and also destroy sinners. That was widely perceived to be what the Messiah was going to do. For example, there are some there's a work of literature that was written around 100 BC. It's called the Psalms of Solomon, and they're not actually by Solomon. They're actually by Pharisees. They represent a piece of Pharisaic literature. So Pharisees wrote these, and one of them is devoted to the Messiah, and yeah, he's going to come, he's going to smash the Romans, he's going to restore the kingship, he's going to destroy sinners, and things like that. So this was a very common understanding of the Messiah, and presumably it influenced what John thought Jesus was going to do, but then he saw Jesus not doing that. Mm-hmm. And it led to doubt. And so he sent the message and said, is it you or not? And Jesus's reply is very interesting. He tell John what you see and hear. The lame walk, the dead are raised, and he names a bunch of different things, you know, several, like five or six different things that he's been doing. And the poor have good news preached to them. And I was attending an exhibit of the Dead Sea Scrolls a few years ago here in the United States. It was touring the United States. And they had, at the time, these little electronic devices. They looked like paddles, but you could punch a number into the paddle and hold it up to your ear, and it would play a recording for you to describe an exhibit. And so I was looking at an exhibit of a document. It was from one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was very small. But I typed in the number, I put it up to my ear, and it lists exactly the things that Jesus named for John the Baptist as proof that he was the Messiah. The lame walk, the dead are raised, the poor have good news preached to them. It was the same list with almost no variation. And what I was listening to in the Dead Sea Scrolls was a recording of a document called the Messianic Apocalypse. And what the Messianic Apocalypse does is it describes things that the Messiah is going to do. And instead of portraying the Messiah the way many people thought, is the Messiah essentially as a miracle worker, which is what, of course, Jesus was. That was one of the things he was doing as part of his ministry, was all these miracles and preaching the good news to the poor. So it looks like we have a second understanding of the Messiah that's out there, that in the first century, that was held, for example, by the Dead Sea Scrolls community. And when John sends his query to Jesus and says, "Are you the one or not?" he's thinking, "Are you the political Messiah?" And of course, Jesus is not. But what he does is he points John to the other understanding of the Messiah as a miracle worker and says, "Tell him what you see and hear. I'm doing all these things." Mm-hmm. And thus, I'm that kind of Messiah. I'm not the political kind. I'm this other kind.
Oh, what a great question. Thank you so much for that question. That brings us right to the first break. We'll take that break and be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. Jimmy Akin is with us this hour for an open forum. It's an internet open forum. All of the questions have already been gathered. And this one comes from Nicholas. Nicholas says, soul sleep. I've read everything on Catholic Answers, including your own article, Jimmy Akin. Recent rebuttal to Luke 15 was this refers to angels but not saints, as they are dead until raised. Or in the Transfiguration, these were mere visions.
Okay, so I should mention what soul sleep is. It's a view that is kind of a minority view in various Christian circles. It's particularly common in Seventh-day Adventism, but it is found in some other groups of Protestants as well. And the basic idea, there are different variants on it, but the basic idea is that you are not conscious between death and resurrection. Sometimes this is called Christian mortalism, and the idea is that you die, meaning basically cease to exist, and then God reconstitutes you, kind of like a transporter, I guess, on the last day. And another version says, well, no, you do continue to exist, but you're unconscious, and that's often called soul sleep. But both with soul sleep and Christian mortalism, you have the idea of there's no conscious experience in the afterlife until you get to the resurrection. And, you know, we have various resources about this on Catholic.com. I've written about it, I guess, since you tell me you've read my article on it. After 30 years, I don't remember all the articles I've written. Nicholas talks here about a couple of passages. He says a recent rebuttal that he encountered to Luke 15 was that this referred to angels, but not saints, as they are dead until raised. So it sounds like he was encountering a Christian mortalist there. I'm not really sure off the top of my head what passage he's referring to, because Luke 15 has three parables in it. It's got the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, and the parable of the lost son, also known as the parable of the prodigal son. And there aren't angels in any of those, parables, really. Or I suppose at the end of the parable of the lost sheep, Jesus has just said that there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. And that could be interpreted as being the joy of angels. I wouldn't tend to use this passage as an argument for against soul sleep, because it is plausibly understood is the joy in heaven is either by angels or God. I mean, sometimes the divine passive is used as a way of communicating something is true of God. Like when Jesus says, all power in heaven and earth has been given to me, that's a divine passive. He means God has given me all power on heaven and on earth. And so when you hear that there's more joy in heaven, that could be that over these sinners that could who repent, that could be a reference to God's joy, or at a minimum, it could be a reference to the angels' joy. but I don't see any proof that humans are involved in this passage, and therefore I wouldn't use this passage against soul sleep. Maybe some other people do, but I wouldn't, because I don't think it's a good one. A passage that I would cite in against soul sleep occurs in the next chapter in Luke 16, which has the account of Lazarus and the rich man. In this parable, or in this account, both Lazarus and the rich man and Abraham are depicted as being conscious in the afterlife. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves what value does this parable have in informing us about the afterlife? Well, you could say it's just a parable and we shouldn't assign any value to it. But I think there are two problems with that view. The first one is it's not actually clear that it's just a parable. This is distinct from Jesus's other parables in a number of ways. One of them is Lazarus has a name, and that is not at all what we see in Jesus's other parables. It's always there was a king, or there was a man, or there was a father who had two sons. Nobody's got names. And here, somebody has a name for the first and only time in a parable. And this Lazarus that we read about in the account, he dies, and then after death, there's a proposal that he go back and show himself to the living. Psychelet.
That sounds awfully familiar.
Did Jesus know anyone named Lazarus who died and then came back and showed himself to the living?
Darren's helping me out. He's like, yes, say yes, say yes. Yes, he did, the brother of Mary and Martha.
Right, and that account is mentioned in John chapter 11. And also Mary and Martha are mentioned in Luke. So we know that Luke was aware of the Bethany family. So this actually may not be as much of a parable as you think it might, as you might think it is. It may be more, that's why I called it an account. Also, there's a second reason. Even if you say this is just a parable, maybe it's loosely inspired by the story of Lazarus, but it doesn't say what really happened to him. Okay, fine. But notice that Jesus's parables are informed by real life. I mean, when he says there was this guy and he went out and sowed seed, well, guess what? Farmers are real. Or there was a guy and he had a vineyard. Well, guess what? Vintners are real. Or there was a guy and he had two sons. Well, guess what? Fathers are real. You go through his parables, they're all based on real life experiences. And so knowing that, if he then depicts three people in this parable as conscious in the afterlife, we would assume this parable is informed by real life, just like all the other ones are. And so right. Just like fathers and kings and vintners and farmers exist, so do conscious afterlives. Then there are other passages. Now, Nicholas also mentions the transfiguration. And what he, I assume, has in mind there is the fact Moses and Elijah appear. And the claim being made to him is it's just a vision of Moses and Elijah. They're not really there. Okay, you can assert that, but you don't have any proof of that. What the text says is that Moses and Elijah appeared and talked with Jesus. It does not say that just images of them appeared. It says they appeared. And so you can reply and say, you know, it says they appeared. That's what I'm going with. If you want to deny that, you can deny that, but the text is not on your side. There also are passages in the book of Revelation where we have people who have been killed in the great tribulation coming up to heaven. They're clearly conscious in the afterlife. We also in the Old Testament have 1 Samuel 28, where the medium of Endor conjures up the spirit of Samuel. And he is, at least while she's talking to him, he's conscious in the afterlife. And it says it's Samuel. It doesn't say it's a demon pretending to be Samuel. It doesn't say it's a trick. The inspired author of 1 Samuel says it was Samuel. So I think we actually have quite a good bit of evidence for conscious afterlife in both the Old and the New Testament, not even to mention, in, for example, 2 Maccabees, you have the deceased high priest Onias and the deceased prophet Jeremiah appearing to Judah Maccabee and their conscience in the afterlife. So I know that's not in the Seventh-day Adventist canon, but it is part of pre-Christian Jewish literature. They were envisioning a conscious afterlife.
Nicholas, thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. I'm going to go to Kelly now, who asks this. Our bishop interprets penitemini in such a way that we are required to abstain from gravies and soups made from meat in the Fridays of Lent. How many other dioceses follow this interpretation?
Well, I don't have statistics on that. I have never heard of an American diocese taking that interpretation. There may be some, but I'm not aware of statements that have been made, and I certainly haven't taken a tally of them. What is being referred to here is a document that was released by Paul VI in the 1960s following Vatican II. The name penitimini means y'all will do penance. Mm-hmm. And so it regulates the penitential disciplines, including the laws of fast and abstinence. And if you study the legislative history of this question, there was at one time a prohibition on soups and sauces, including gravies, made with meat. But then that prohibition gets dropped. And one of the standard principles of law is if they change the law, the change is significant. And so if you have a restriction and then subsequent laws repeat everything but that one exemption or that one condition, then you should regard it as no longer binding. And so by my read and the read of the canon lawyers I'm familiar with, the penitimini, we are no longer required to abstain from gravies or soups or sauces that are made with meat. Now, it's still a good thing to do. You can still abstain from them. Personally, I do. But I don't think it's required by the law, which creates an interesting situation. What would you be bound by if you're in a diocese where your bishop has said, I think penitimini prohibits consuming these foods? Well, I would say, at least based on my study of the law, which has been considerable in this area on this exact question, I would say I think the bishop is mistaken. And when a bishop misreads the law applies. And so if the law does not require you to abstain from these foods, then even if your bishop thinks it does, if he's mistaken, the law really doesn't. And so you would not be legally required to abstain from these foods.
Thank you.
Unless your bishop uses his legislative authority to not just give his interpretation of the law, but to impose a restriction in his diocese, because bishops can use their legislative authority to create particular law for their own diocese, and they can regulate the exercise of fast and abstinence in their diocese. And therefore, if the bishop says, I think penitimini requires us to abstain from these, he's not using his authority. He's expressing his opinion. And I would say I think that opinion is mistaken. But if he says, as bishop, I'm using my authority to create a regulation for my diocese, and these foods are not allowed in my diocese, then that would bind the faithful of his diocese, and you would be obliged to follow it.
Check the bishop's statements carefully there. That was from Kelly. Kelly, thank you very, very much. Appreciate the question. It's an internet open forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and as he told us last hour, tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, it is...
Wait. Patrons questions.
I was trying to think of the word patrons. I got stuck on the word patrons. Patrons questions. And what do you got?
Oh, things like, can you be possessed by an angel, and Ouija boards, and Noah's flood and the Younger Dryas melt off, and all kinds of stuff.
Those are fun ones. You get a whole variety. Last week, it's the kid who could affect electronic devices. He was modern. What do you call him?
The 21st century poltergeist.
Check it out, because Jimmy has already assured me the kid cannot put you into the cornfield. So we are going to take a very quick break. If you want to check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you go to mysterious.fm, mysterious.fm. Lots more cool questions coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend 4 fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
In These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes, best-selling author Rod Bennett gives a riveting re-examination of gospel events from the ground floor perspective of Christ's own hand-picked successors. In his trademark storytelling style, Bennett movingly depicts what it was like for the apostles to witness Jesus' teaching and miracles up close. Why did he call them, and what did he intend for them to do? Order your copy of These 12 today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music for a Thursday afternoon when Jimmy's here doing open forum. I didn't want to say anything before. I was afraid Darren might have forgotten, and I did not want to draw attention to it. But nope, Darren didn't forget. There's a little bit of groovy music for you. Today's open forum is of the internet variety. All the questions have come from the internet. Jimmy Akin, here to answer the internet's questions. And on we go. Here's a nice, easy one. This is a nice, easy question. Erwin asks, how does God answer our prayers? He adds, how do chapter 21, verse 22, and Mark chapter 11, verse 24 come into play? Thank you very much, Jimmy Akin. Smiley face, smiley face.
So how does God answer our prayers is a question that could be taken in a number of different senses, but by the context of Matthew 21, 22 and Mark 11, 24, I think that points us in the direction of what Erwin is after. If you look up Matthew 21, 22 and Mark 11, 24, they're passages in which Jesus is encouraging people to pray, and he's basically being very positive about it. In the Mark passage, he says, therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. And then in the Matthew passage, he says, whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive if you have faith. So these are very positive exhortations. They are clearly designed to encourage people to pray and to have faith in God. Now, We've all had the experience, though, of praying for something and not receiving it. And so there is a question of how do we explain when we pray for something and we, you know, we're trusting God to give it to us, so we have faith in him, and we don't receive it. How are we to explain that in light of these passages? And I think that's what Irwin is actually concerned about here. How do these fit with our Christian experience of not being able to make ourselves all trillionaires who are immortal and lived in air-conditioned luxury every minute of our lives just by asking God, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that the answer is these statements are meant to be encouraging, and they're meant to encourage us to pray, but Jesus is not expecting us to camp out on them as if they were absolutes and there were no other factors that were relevant. And I don't think the authors of the Gospels were expecting that either, because the authors of the Gospel had the same experience as the rest of us. You don't always get what you ask. Mm-hmm. And they knew that, and they included these passages anyway. And so I think they expect us to read these passages, not just in light of our Christian experience, but in light of the other passages in the Gospels that they wrote. And one of the things that is in all three of the Synoptic Gospels is the Garden of Gethsemane. And in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prays to his Father, Sykelet. Does God give Jesus what he asks for?
He does not.
He does not. And Jesus also submits his prayer to God's will. He says, nevertheless, not my will be done, but your will be done. And that is a major moment in the Gospels. And the evangelists expect us to know about it because they wrote it. And they expect us to read these other passages about prayer in light of everything we know from the Gospels, including Jesus' experience in the Garden of Gethsemane. So God can say no, that Garden of Gethsemane passage teaches us. God can say no on the grounds that it is not God's will in a particular case. So we need to balance the positive exhortation that we find in Matthew 21 and Mark 11 by the fact that it may not be God's will to grant a particular request, as we see in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is, if I recall correctly, in Matthew 26 and Mark 14. So just a few chapters aside of that encouragement to pray.
All right. Irwin, thank you very much for the question and for the two smiley faces for Jimmy. Brian asks this. What is hardness of heart? When it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, what did it mean? How does it tie into Judas's decision? How does it tie into our spiritual growth today?
Okay, so hardness of heart is a phrase that refers to determination. Hypothetically, it can be used in a good sense, you know, like I've hardened my heart to go down to the soup kitchen and serve the poor tonight. Well, that would be a good thing. And if I'm really determined to go do that, I could say, well, I've hardened my heart to do that. But that's not the way it's normally used. Normally, it's referring to someone who's doing something bad. And so we read about Pharaoh hardening his heart against letting the Israelites go. And we read about the Israelites having a hard heart and a stiff neck that would cause them to resist obeying God's law. And generally, when the term hardness of heart is used, it's referring to the condition of a determination to do something bad. And so when it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, that can be understood in more than one sense. one of the ways that it could be understood is God literally did that. You know, Pharaoh had a pliant heart and initially, and God decided, no, I want Pharaoh to do something bad. So I'm going to override Pharaoh's free will and make him determined to do something bad. But most people don't think that's literally what happened, because if God determined that Pharaoh would do something bad, you know, do something sinful, and overrode his free will, who's responsible for that act of evil, Cy Kellett?
Oh, God would clearly be responsible in that instance. Yeah, overriding someone's will.
God,
if you have the
would
power
be responsible.
Didn't I say God, or did I say Pharaoh?
Yeah.
Oh, I meant to say God. Yes, God would be responsible.
Yeah. Right. And since God is all good, most people would conclude, okay, this isn't meant in a fully literal sense. A better way to take it is that God allowed Pharaoh's heart to become hard. And we have an earlier indication in the text of Pharaoh hardening his own heart. But because of the idiom that biblical authors at the time that Exodus was written used, they tend to speak in a way that it just attributes everything to God. So if something happens, God did it. And they don't go into the, well, did he actually do it, or did he just allow it to happen? But it would seem that, to my mind, the better way to take that passage is God allowed Pharaoh to harden his heart. When it comes to Judas, well, we have some indication was more than just Judas that was involved there. We're told more than once in the Gospels that the devil entered Judas and caused him to betray Jesus, and so there was demonic involvement. That doesn't mean he was possessed and not in control of himself. It seems that he was in control of himself, because after he has betrayed Jesus, he repents in Matthew and says, "I have betrayed innocent blood." And so he feels guilty for what he did. And so this doesn't look like a case of full-blown possession. Instead, it looks like a case of demonic influence in a way that did not override Judas's free will. But at least at a certain point, Judas had a heart that was hard enough to betray Jesus, and he did so. We can speculate on why, but he did seem to freely choose to betray Jesus. Now, even though there was demonic influence in that decision. Now, how does all this tie in to our spiritual growth today? Well, today we have a choice, just like people in the Bible did. We can either harden our heart against God's will and resist doing what he wants us to, which will ultimately result in our own unhappiness, because what God wants us to do will benefit us in the long run. Or we can have a heart that's compliant, that goes along with what God wants us to do. And therefore, you know, there's the saying in the Old Testament, if today you hear his voice, harden not your heart. So we should be attentive to what God says and what he wants us to do, his moral law, and we should be willing to go along with that, because it's ultimately for our own good. So we should not harden our hearts as part of our, not if we want to spiritually grow today.
Brian, thank you for the question. That brings us to our break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hi, this is Doug Keck on Mother Angelica Answering the Call. Father Joseph Mary and I mine decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Join us Sunday for a half hour of teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers from the one and only Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it is an internet open forum today. All of our questions have already gotten to us via the internet, and we've gathered them up here, and Jimmy is answering them. The inexhaustible internet, and this one comes from Jonathan.
The insatiable internet.
Indeed, right. And now you don't even know who you're talking to. These questions could be coming from an artificial intelligence. Well, maybe not. I don't know actually how that works. I may have exaggerated what they could do. Jonathan asks this. I'm going to just go with, I'm assuming on the basis of all other evidence that Jonathan is a human being. How can we have a better time converting Muslims?
I assume that Jonathan means how can we more effectively convert Muslims? And the... there's a lot that's already being done in that regard. One of the things that is not, a lot of people aren't really aware of, is that many in historically Muslim countries actually are attracted to Christianity. And there are a lot of secret Christians in Muslim countries. In fact, it's even reported that in some Muslim regions, there has been a wave of Jesus appearing to people in dreams, telling them they need to become his followers. And you have a large group of hidden Christians within the Muslim community that keep their faith on the down low because of, in some areas, they can give you varying degrees of persecution up to and including death if you leave Islam. And so just like Christians often had to keep their faith on the down low during the Roman persecution period, there are Christians who are keeping their faith on the down low during the current Muslim persecution period in some countries, not in other countries. There are also Muslims who are intellectually curious about the Christian faith. One of the things that I think is important in all evangelization is being a loving person. There are various voices in the Muslim community that are very strident and that are very hostile towards outsiders. And there are Muslim apologists who are like that. And it can be very easy to respond in kind. If someone's being a jerk, it's easy to be a jerk back to them. But ultimately, that's not winning. If you come across, you want to come across as strong, but strong does not mean a jerk. You can come across as strong and someone who's not threatened. So, for example, if I were debating a Muslim apologist, I would do my best to, you know, be friendly and confident. And even if he gets hostile, I'm going to be friendly and confident because friendly, that's my goal anyway, because friendly and confident are winning. They convey a better impression. They convey, I'm not a jerk. They convey, that's what the friendliness does, and they convey, I'm not threatened by this, which is what the confidence does. And so being friendly and confident, whether you're in a formal debate or whether you're talking to someone, is important. Also, responding, and this is true of other situations, but responding to a person's actual concerns is important. Years ago, after the internet first became commercially available, I got an email from someone in a Muslim country. And the person, I remember the email, the subject line of the email was, "My heart is searching for God." And what this person wanted to know about was the Christian view of women. Could I explain how Christianity views women? And it, and this is not a standard apologetic topic. You know, the standard is like existence of God, resurrection of Jesus, stuff like that. But that's not what this person was concerned about at the moment. Now, it turns out she was raised in a Muslim society, so she knew from experience how women are treated in a Muslim society. But then she went to America for college, and she saw how women are treated in a predominantly Christian society. And she wanted to know more about that. She wanted to understand it. What exactly is the Christian view of women, and why are they treated the way they are in Christian circles? And she was very impressed by how women were treated in Christian circles compared to how they were treated in Muslim circles. And that was attracting her to the Christian faith. And so, in order to be a good apologist, I answered her question. I didn't start reading her a bunch of arguments for God's existence or Jesus' resurrection or critiques of the Prophet Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
I answered her actual concern. And I think being friendly and confident and answering people's actual concerns will cause us to have a better time, or in other words, be more efficient converting anybody, including Muslims.
Thank you so much for the question. I really actually very much appreciate that question, Jonathan, about sharing the good news and the answer that it solicited. So thank you very much, Jonathan. I'm going to go to a question from PL. Hi, Jimmy. I recently spoke with an atheist, and he asked me, why the Christian God?
Well, if an atheist asked me that, I guess one of my first temptations would be to say it's not the Christian God. If what I believe is true, he's the God of everybody. So it's not like we've got a pantheon up there of the Jewish God and the Christian God and the Muslim God and the Shinto God and the Buddhist God. And we got to pick from among this pantheon, whose God are we going to be followers of? If what I believe about God is true, then there's one ultimate God, and he's the God of everybody, not just Christians. He's also the God of Jews and Muslims and every single human being, whether they know about him or not. And so I would say that that what we can talk about is, well, so why should I believe that God is like what you say? And there are various philosophical arguments that can be proposed that illustrate aspects of what God is like from the Christian point of view. For example, if you read the first part of St. Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologia, he's got extensive arguments for trying to prove God has different attributes. So from the fact, like one of them is God is simple, meaning he's not made of parts. And once you've got that, you can then try to deduce, okay, well, if he doesn't have any parts, then he's not extended space. He doesn't have a physical body, at least apart from the incarnation. So he's an immaterial spirit. Also, he's not going to have parts that are extended in time. So he's going to be eternal. He's going to be outside of time. And he'll deduce that he's omnipotent and he has personal agency and all kinds of different things. And so there are various philosophical arguments that you can use, not a single argument, but a collection of arguments that you can use to try to establish different aspects of the Christian belief about God. At some point, though, you want to make the connection to biblical revelation. Because there are things about God, like the fact God is a Trinity and that God became incarnate as Jesus Christ, that cannot be deduced philosophically. You need to appeal to empirical data, you know, what's been revealed in the course of world history. And so there are different ways of arguing for the credibility of the Christian message on these grounds. One way is by talking about the reliability of the New Testament, but a very common way in apologetics is talking about the resurrection of Christ, because something needs to explain the early Christian reports of Jesus's resurrection. And you can make a list of different possibilities. It's just like in any paranormal or supernatural investigation, you want to consider the natural explanations first. But if the natural explanations don't end up working, if they're not plausible on their own, then that points you in the direction of a paranormal or supernatural explanation. So you make a list of all the things that could explain the different aspects of the Christian message. You know, Jesus was crucified, died, he was buried, he was seen alive again after he ascended into heaven. And you try to say what could explain these different parts of the Christian truth claim. The natural explanations are all very implausible. And that gives us reason to propose a paranormal or supernatural in this nation. And so between using philosophical argument about certain aspects of God, we also would want to appeal to divine revelation as illustrated and by the resurrection of Christ for evidence. And in those ways, we can flesh out the Christian understanding of God and why we have reason to.
PL, I'm going to say thanks very much for that question. This next question is long, so I'm going to read it real quick to try to give you as much time as I can, Jimmy. This comes from Gabriel. Gabriel asks, can future popes keep going back and forth writing motu proprios that abrogate another motu proprio, then the next pope abrogates that motu proprio, then the next pope abrogates that one? For example, Pope Benedict XVI's motu proprio Summorum Pontificum on the extraordinary form of the Latin Mass liturgy, and Pope Francis's motu proprio Traditionis Custodis, going backwards on the TLM, and let's say a pope after Francis writes a motu proprio making it accessible again, and then the next pope, and it goes back and forth. Could that happen? And then what does that mean if it did?
Could it happen? Yes, it could happen, because popes have free will, and they don't all share the same views. And so they can revise aspects of church law. And we've seen, you know, Pope Benedict revised an aspect of church law in regard to the traditional Latin Mass. Pope Francis made another modification, and a future pope can make further modifications. If it did, well, it means that the popes had different views, or at least came to have different views about the best way to handle a situation. And so they thought it was worth implementing a new solution and trying it and see if it accomplishes what they wanted. It doesn't have any doctrinal significance in that, because this is just a matter of ecclesiastical law. It is not a matter of divine law. Divine law does not say, thou must or must not worship according to the traditional Latin Mass. The traditional Latin Mass is a legitimate way of celebrating the liturgy, but so are other forms, like the Chaldean Rite and the Maronite Rite and the post-Vatican II Rite. All of those are legitimate ways of celebrating the liturgy. None of them are divinely mandated, and therefore there's no particular doctrinal significance to what a pope might mandate in this regard. It's just his pastoral judgment about what will serve the church best in a particular situation. And he may be right, he may be wrong, but it doesn't go beyond that.
Gabriel, thanks very, very much for that question. I think I will leave it there because we are just about at the end. Jimmy Akin, our guest. We'll have Jimmy back again tomorrow. Is that right, Darren? We'll have Jimmy back again tomorrow. We'll do some weird questions with Jimmy Akin, have more fun. While we're on our way out, I will invite you again to come to our conference in September, the last full weekend in September, the 21st through the 24th. We're going to gather here in San Diego. Scott Hahn will be there as a speaker. Jimmy will be one of our speakers. Sister Regina Marie Gorman will be our keynote speaker. Dale Alquist will be there. Lots and lots of others. And we're going to talk about God. I Believe in God is the name of the conference. If that is of interest to you, check it out at CatholicAnswersConference.com. And if you decide to come, use the promo code EARLY, and then you will save $50 off your conference ticket. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing you tomorrow to do this again.
My pleasure.
And that does it for us. Again, you can check out Jimmy at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or just do the word mysterious.fm, mysterious.fm. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.